So I'm going to be talking on the theme of really how could a future government undermine or repeal this carbon pricing scheme. And I'm going to be speaking in particular to three points. First of all, what's the legislative process for setting scheme caps, and how does that play into this issue of whether the government could undermine the scheme from within, if you like? Secondly, what are the legal and constitutional steps required to repeal the scheme? And thirdly, if the scheme were repealed, would compensation have to be paid to the holders of carbon units? So I'm going to deal with each of those in turn, and hopefully they won't be too boring. So first of all, looking at this question of the legislative process for setting scheme caps. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of a 101 on legislation and regulations, and apologies if this is a bit too obvious for some people, but it is important for analysing the Clean Energy Act cap setting mechanism. Essentially, I think everyone would know that, so we've got a piece of legislation or a statute or an act of parliament or an act, they're all the same things. They're a law that is required to be passed by a majority of both houses of parliament before it becomes law. I think that's pretty easy. But then regulations, they're basically subordinate laws, also known as delegated legislation, and they're rules that are made by the executive under authority delegated to the executive within an act of parliament. And they usually contain items of technical detail that are required to give further substance to an act, which tends to be kind of higher level or more principles based. And the executive's authority to make those regulations is limited by the scope of the authority that's been delegated to them under a particular act. Now, the way that regulations work is that once that they've been made by the executive and they've been registered on the Federal Register, they have legal effect, they have binding force, but they're subject to what's called parliamentary disallowance. So there's a mechanism whereby the parliament can scrutinise regulations, and the minister responsible for regulations has to table them in parliament, and then there's a time period within which either House of Parliament can pass a motion disallowing the instrument, and if that happens, it requires a majority of either house. If that happens, then the regulations cease to have effect. Now, all of that's just by way of background, but it's very relevant to the carbon pricing scheme, because the way the carbon pricing scheme works is that, or that the cap setting mechanism works, is that it'll be done by the executive under regulations. The process for setting scheme caps really involves the interaction between the Climate Change Authority, the executive, and the parliament. And the basic way that happens under the Act is that the Climate Change Authority will advise the government on scheme caps, and then the government, the executive, will set the caps in regulations on a five-year rolling basis. So that means that in any given year, as of 2014, you will know what the first 5 years of the floating price phase caps will be in advance, and then in any subsequent year, you'll know what the caps will be at least 5 years out. So the government sets those through regulations, and then of course the legislature can disallow, the parliament can disallow those regulations, as I've just explained, through the disallowance motion. But then crucially, and this is what I want to highlight, there's a default mechanism in the Clean Energy Act. Basically, how this works is that the Clean Energy Act itself provides for 5 years worth of default caps that are consistent with the 2020 target of 5% below 2000 levels. And crucially, these will apply if regulations setting out the scheme caps are disallowed by the House of Parliament or if they're not made. And then there's a similar mechanism that will apply for caps after the first 5 years that will essentially be a reduction, a strengthening based on the previous cap. So there's a default mechanism for kind of ratcheting the targets up or the caps down. So basically what this means, if, say, an Abbott government were to win at the next election but didn't have control of the Senate, it wouldn't be able to kind of hollow out the scheme from within by refusing to set scheme caps, because if it refused to set scheme caps, the default caps under the Act would apply. And secondly, if it tried to set really, really weak caps, and if it didn't have control of the Senate, then presumably the Senate would disallow the regulations that contain the very weak caps, so lower than the 5% equivalent, then again the default mechanism would apply. So basically what this means is that if a future government wanted to undermine the scheme, its only option is really to try and repeal it. And that gets to my second point, which is, well, what are the constitutional and legal steps required to repeal a carbon pricing scheme? So again, just to go back to a little bit of Parliamentary Procedure 101, so to repeal an Act of Parliament or statute requires another Act of Parliament. So to repeal the Clean Energy Act and the associated 18 pieces of legislation would require another Act of Parliament to pass both Houses of Parliament before that could be repealed. If a government, I'm just talking generally here, if a government does not have a majority in the Senate, so they pass a bill in the House, it goes to the Senate, and the Senate rejects the legislation, then the government must wait 3 months before reintroducing that bill into the House and then submitting it to the Senate again. If the Senate passes it, if the Senate rejects that bill the second time, then the government has a double dissolution trigger. It can call, it can dissolve both houses of parliament and call a double dissolution election, which involves a full House election as per normal and a full Senate election as opposed to the normal half Senate election. And then after the new House members and senators have taken their seats following a double dissolution election, the rejected bill can be reintroduced again. And if it fails to pass the Senate again, the government can request the Governor General to call a joint sitting of Parliament, and they can attempt to pass the legislation at a joint sitting. So if they have the numbers in the House, which is a bigger House, to kind of offset the narrowness of any lack of majority in the Senate, then they may be able to pass the legislation at joint sitting. So this would essentially play out in a potential kind of Abbott government repeal scenario as follows. So let's assume that at the next election, next federal election is held after 1 July 2013, so it's likely to be somewhere around November 2013. Let's assume hypothetically that an Abbott-led coalition wins a majority in the lower house and forms government, but does not win a majority in the upper house. So that means it would face a hostile Senate until at least 1 July 2017. Let's assume that the Abbott government introduces repealing legislation and passes through the lower house, in which they have a majority, soon after taking office, so towards the end of 2013. The Greens will still have the balance of power in the Senate. The current Senate will keep its place till 1 July 2014, and then I'm assuming that they retain the balance of power in the new Senate after 1 July 2014. So Greens and Labor have said that they would block any attempt to repeal the legislation. So they reject the repealing legislation. The Abbott government would have to wait the constitutionally mandated 3 months, reintroduce the legislation again to pass the House, and then the Senate blocks it again, giving the Abbott government a double dissolution trigger. Let's assume that it then uses that trigger and either wins a majority in the Senate or a sufficient majority in the lower house to pass the repealing legislation at a joint sitting. So assuming all of that happens, if you take into account the three-month waiting period between the rejection of the bills, the time for parliamentary inquiries by both houses into the legislation, you take into account, you know, the time for calling and holding a double dissolution, and if necessary, or reintroducing the bills, and if necessary, holding a joint sitting, it's likely that at the earliest you'd actually see this scheme repealed kind of mid-2014. And there's a kind of a tricky constitutional argument that means that they might even have to wait longer for that. But I don't have time to kind of delve into that now. So what are the implications of this in terms of the scheme's operation and winding it back? Well, basically, the scheme is going to become harder to repeal in a kind of political and practical sense the more that there are carbon units with a floating price phase vintage year circulating in the scheme. So vintage years of 2015-16 or beyond in the scheme. So obviously, if you're trying to repeal a scheme after 1 July 2015, it's going to be logistically very difficult. But the point I want to emphasise is it's still going to be challenging if we assume that all of those things happen and that the scheme is repealed in kind of mid to late 2014. There's still actually going to be a lot of floating price phase vintage units circulating in the system then, because the government will be conducting periodic advance auctions of floating price phase units, even during the fixed price phase, to establish a forward price curve and to facilitate hedging. So kind of the closer you get to the 2015, the more of those there are going to be in the system. So I think that's a sort of a relevant point about the kind of that there are these constitutional hurdles that will make it more difficult to kind of repeal the scheme. And then this sort of takes me to my third and final point, which is just a brief one, which is about whether this issue of whether compensation would need to be paid to the holders of carbon units. It's been this has been a point of debate and commentary that happened particularly kind of a couple of months ago. And the issue stems from a clause in the Commonwealth Constitution, Section 51, Paragraph 31, which gives the Federal Parliament the power to make laws, quote, with respect to the acquisition of property on just terms. You might recognise this from the Castle. Basically, the Commonwealth has the power to compulsorily acquire property so long as it does so by paying fair compensation. Now, the debate has tended to assume that if a carbon unit is property, then compensation will have to be paid. And the debate's kind of focused on, well, is a carbon unit property? I think this misses the point. So it's very clear that a carbon unit is a form of personal property. Not only is that designated in the Clean Energy Act, but even without that designation, it would clearly be personal property. A carbon unit is a clearly defined valuable statutory instrument that can be possessed, controlled, transferred, assigned, and mortgaged by its owner. It possesses all the characteristics of personal property. So there's no doubt that it's property, but that does not necessarily mean that repealing the scheme would require the payment of compensation. Because to enliven the just terms acquisition clause, it's not sufficient that you extinguish valuable proprietary rights. It's not sufficient that you kind of impair or extinguish someone's property. The High Court has been very clear on this, that what is actually required to effect an acquisition of that property is that the Commonwealth obtains a corresponding proprietary benefit. So they can't just repeal it. The Commonwealth has to obtain a corresponding proprietary benefit. And in the case of carbon units, if the repealing legislation is structured so as to just repeal or extinguish carbon units, there's no transfer of those carbon units into the Commonwealth Registry account, which they wouldn't do if they didn't want to pay compensation. So if it's a straight repeal, then I see no corresponding proprietary benefit that the Commonwealth obtains from extinguishing those carbon units. And so as a result, I think there's quite a strong conclusion that the repeal of the scheme, if done in that way, would not necessitate the payment of compensation. So I don't have time to sort of go into the sort of legal analysis behind that, but I've done some writing on this. I wrote a piece in Inside Story a couple of months ago, which I'm happy to refer to people if they want to get in contact with me, or you can probably find it via Google. And that kind of outlines the case law that I based that analysis on. And the key High Court case is the case of ICM Agriculture and the Commonwealth. But so there's a bit of analysis behind that, but essentially I think that's the right conclusion, is that the carbon units aren't compensable. So just to wrap up, the final thought, though, I think on that point is that this may not necessarily be a bad thing, because it may compel that the holders of carbon units that have been purchased to lobby to retain the scheme and to not have the scheme repealed if they've got all of this kind of value stored up in carbon units. So I'll just leave you with that thought and conclude by saying that, in conclusion, that the capacity of a future government to undermine the scheme is really affected by the interaction between law, regulation and politics. It's going to be impossible to hollow out by not setting scheme caps. There's going to be lots of constitutional hurdles to try and repeal it. And the law on compensation potentially complicates the politics around repeal. So I'll leave it there and happy to take any questions.